Penn State's reputation in the fashion industry is something you would hear from everyone when you're in New York City.
I will say we're quite well known for being hard workers.
Kent is really known for delivering well-rounded students.
Kent has one of the most prestigious fashion programs in the U.S. and also internationally ranked.
Our alumni are in every corner of the industry, every job position that you can imagine.
They all are ready. They have all the courses. They have everything under, you know, under their belt.
Hi, it's Martha Stewart. You know, I spend a lot of time thinking about dirt. At 3 a.m., at all hours of the day, really. What people don't know is that not all dirt is the same. You need dirt with the right kind of nutrients. New Miracle-Gro organic raised bed and garden soil is so dense, so full of nutrient-rich, high-quality ingredients. Miracle-Gro is simply the best.
And we are back with an all-new episode of Keep It. I'm Ira Madison III.
I'm Louis Fertel, and I'm on cloud nine because I'm awash in awards. Still, they are just pummeling us with awards this month.
I think everyone has been confused about why the Emmys were directly after the Golden Globes. And you would be forgiven for wondering that because, you know, it's not like many people mentioned the strike last night or why the Emmys got pushed back. Truly just the John Oliver team.
Right. Yes. And also, I don't know that I prefer that the Emmys be an actual part of the gauntlet of awards that we get at this time of year. But in a way, it's always been kind of weird that they were in September. So I'm just embracing this break from normalcy for a second, even if the same people from television that won awards last week won them this week. And it's sort of a no-win scenario for those people because, like, how charming can you be while, you know, having to act humble and excited to be there and surprised while winning the same award, not only at the Golden Globes last week, but also at the Critics' Choice yesterday and then the Emmys the day after.
I would say, and we'll get into this when we talk about the full ceremony this week, but man, you know, one, the stylists are running out of looks, okay? Some people were looking a goddamn mess at the Emmys, and it's when you just got event after event after event, that is like, that is truly like packing for a destination wedding or like a destination birthday or something. You're by the second, third day, you're ready, you're re-wearing things. You're sort of like, this thing I brought didn't fit. Like, what are we doing here? And I would say that also, if we're going to move the Emmys, I like the fact that they can all sort of be in the same season. But if we're going to move the Emmys, we got to get out of the old requirement of where it was tied to the traditional network TV schedule, because friends were watching it with me and were talking about, oh, why isn't Fellow Travelers or something nominated? And someone was like, wasn't this show on in 2022 or something? And I'm like,
right,
Fellow Travelers will be nominated next year.
Yes.
Which means we're going to see Matt Bomer and Jonathan Bailey at the Emmys next time for a show that we've already sort of forgotten about. Someone else brought this up, particularly in terms of The Bear. The fact that Eben Moss Backrack won for The Bear in supporting last night, but they pointed out the fact that every person voting for the Emmys definitely thought that they were voting for season two of this show, because he has a big sort of spotlight episode in season two that makes him a more important character, and he's really on your mind this season. But if you were voting only off of having watched season one, you wouldn't be handing the Emmy to him necessarily, especially when there were bigger, splashier people also in that category, you know?
No, there are lots of TV shows nominated where it's like, I mean, that was on so long ago, I can't believe we're still having a conversation about them. But anyway, even like The White Lotus, I was like, I'm thinking back, I'm like, who did I really love in that show? And everybody was good. All 900 nominees. Yeah. It was like they got a bus to bring them on.
I was happy to see them again, but then I was also like, Jennifer Coolidge, haven't we already celebrated this performance already. Like, it's time to move on from season two. We're awash in the season three casting already. Truly sort of was happy. And I feel like it was very funny when she said thank you to all the evil gays.
That was good, but
knowing how these gays are trying to kill me permeated culture and would not go away, much like a high gay or, well, yes. I feel like we are due to months of gay men with nothing originally funny to say, just quoting, thank you to all the evil gays anytime you're anywhere in a setting of more than three gay men.
Right, and they all have now, like, Etsy pillows with that stitched in already and stuff. Like, it's already overdone and boring, whatever. But speaking of new TV that is actually happening right now, I did over the weekend watch three episodes of fucking Traitors. Now, this is where I belong. I want to be with scheming people who are, I don't know. It's not that they're scheming. It's that they are... It's worked out for them in the past on other shows like Survivor and Big Brother, and now they just get to call themselves master manipulators, whether or not they actually are. We just like to believe it. It's a little bit of a Santa Claus thing. And that said, I'm almost concerned about this cast because they've expired so many major names in master manipulator entertainment on this season. You've got Dan Giesling from Big Brother. You've got Parvati from Survivor. You've got Sandra from Survivor. You've got Nefarious Housewives. You know, just like they've hit many major names already. In addition to Alan Cumming, who is bringing capital Z zeal once again to this hosting role.
I absolutely fucking love the Traitors so much that I watched all three when they dropped on Thursday on Peacock. And then I watched them again this weekend with my friends who had not seen it yet. And I can't stop talking about the Traitors with people. I can't stop texting people. I love that it abandoned the regular people this season, because last year I felt like they didn't really jump in with sort of gusto with giving you good TV. And I feel like now that everyone is on the same playing field, they've been on reality TV before, everyone is sort of game for being a bit crazier. But I will also say that we're seeing a bit that that's to the detriment of Dan Giesling, who hasn't been on TV in like a decade since Big Brother when he won, and then the season where he should have won against Ian Terry. But he's sort of doing a laid back, like trying to stay out of the shadows version, which works on Big Brother, and it does not work on a show like this. And we're seeing how his sort of method of playing the game is backfiring a bit. And it is fun to see now in season two of the show and seeing other sort of additions of it too in the UK and Australia, that people are able to start forming strategies for how to play the game. Because the first season was very much, if you were a faithful, who are the good people trying to weed out the trailers, sort of like you're playing the game Mafia, we're at sort of this extreme disadvantage, I felt like, because you didn't really know the rules of the game. You'd never played it before. But now having seen season one, I feel like people are coming in and bringing sort of an A game to season two with trying to weed out who the traitor is.
Yeah, so if you haven't seen The Traitors, as Ira just said, it's a lot like Mafia or Werewolf, where a couple of people are selected by the producers to be traitors. And like they are supposed to be sussed out by the townspeople contestants. And they don't have much to go off, really. And honestly, I love the casting on this show, but I honestly think The Traitors as a concept is like the maestro movie of reality competitions, which is the talent is there, the working is there, the look is fabulous, it looks incredibly expensive. But the fact of the matter is, they don't have much to do in terms of fooling the other players. I think it takes a bunch of episodes where you get to a point where they have anything even to work off of in terms of sussing out who the villains are. So at first, like, there was a big hubbub online where Trishel, of course, the Real World Las Vegas fame, got Peppermint, Drag Race legend, eliminated because she said, you reacted strangely to something I said, and she took that to mean that Peppermint is a traitor and couldn't keep the facade together. And then people online sort of said about Trishel, well, this feels transphobic or targeted or whatever. This show is about targeting, and they have nothing to go on. Literally, and also Peppermint would be a good traitor. She's so immediately likable, you know, you would not think, oh, well, this person, you know, this person's utterly guileless. How could they be a traitor? So I found that, like, they have to eliminate somebody and they have nothing to go off of. And we as the audience, it's hard to know who to root for or against in that case. Like, who has the harder time manipulating who? It's hard to say.
Mm-hmm. I would just say that two things are true here. One, you do have to eliminate somebody, and Peppermint, after that moment, didn't really defend herself well.
No,
but I will
right.
also say that Trishelle, from what we've seen on the challenge and her conflicts with Anissa and other women of color, that I would say that she has very big, isn't your seat in the back of the bus energy.
Okay, that is specific, yes.
So, also the fact that she anticipated, by the way, that she was extra to Peppermint. Trishelle messaged Peppermint, shown by the screenshot that she put online, several hours before the episodes actually dropped, on the day of them dropping. So how much did you really care?
Yeah, that's interesting. Or maybe she just realized, I mean, maybe she got the episodes early and watched them and then realized how it came across. I have no idea. It appears they are at least giving the traitors interesting, strange things to do now. Like, oh, now you have to find this in episode 3. There's like a poison chalice where they have to give it mm-hmm. to somebody and then slip it under. Like, they have ways to kill the other players that isn't just they have their secret caucus and randomly kill off people. That's another problem with this show. Like, the people who get eliminated, it's not like The Mole where you did the worst on the mole quiz, so you're eliminated by it's you. These people can just literally eliminate the person who is playing the game the best.
Mm-hmm. Which I think is interesting in a way, because it also puts in strategy, because you have to play the game well, but you also have to play the game in a sort of flashy, showy sort of way. Because if you're Marcus Jordan, who, spoiler alert, got killed by the traitors, that's because you were specifically talking to a traitor and pinpointing to them that you sort of knew who they were, right? But Marcus was really only shown saying that to Dan. If you're a person who sort of is bigger at the round table, I feel like expressing an opinion that you think Dan is a traitor, like MJ or shockingly Larsa Pippen, who is usually the dumbest person on The Real Housewives of Miami, is somehow razor sharp here. If you're showy like that, and it's very obvious that you are targeting a specific person, it is harder then to just kill you because you're playing the game very well, because then that will throw suspicion on you as a traitor, you know?
Right, right. I will say, I feel like I'm missing a conversation among the contestants on this show where they rightly decide, logically decide, wouldn't the producers pick a known master manipulator to be one of the traitors? It feels like they aren't thinking, maybe they just aren't that familiar with all of these shows, but it's like, you wouldn't have this season of television unless Dan Giesling, someone like him, is one of the traitors, and he is one of the traitors this season. And they recruit Parvati, of course, one of the legendary Survivor players. There's really like a core group of 5 or 6 people here who are known for their dastardly reality competition ways. And I don't feel like anybody is onto the fact that this season of TV would not exist unless one or more of those people was in the conspiracies, was a traitor.
Absolutely. And I will also say that I do like that they added in this season the opportunity to grab shields and safety within the competitions, because largely I felt like in the first season, the competitions were the weakest part of
yeah.
the show. I still think there needs to be something else added to the competitions that sort of mixes it up.
And links it to the gameplay.
Yes.
It literally just, they make money in these giant games where they have to run across fields and dig up things in meadows and stuff. And then that's completely unrelated to who gets eliminated or what the traitors do or what they have to do. And so it's like there's no conversation between elements of this TV show.
Mm-hmm. Even something where the mole happens and there are people taking money from the pot, etc. You know, there needs to be a little something else going on within the challenges. And I don't yeah. know if that involves two teams or something, but the challenges still remain sort of the less interesting part of the show, because a traitor is always going to be doing well in the challenge because they want to make the same money that the faithfuls do.
Right. So everybody's just on one team. Yeah, there's not even really they're battling against each other or they have reason to distrust each other. So, yeah, even the fun of the game sort of goes away there. Even though Alan Cumming is, of course, dressed like a gay child playing dress up. That's what he looks like to me. You know, like he has a cape and a saber for some reason and he's running around a field. It's really funny.
But I will say the show's just fun and camp. And now I think they actually have the contestants living in that castle, unlike last year where they were not.
Yes.
And so there's just nothing like those shots of people, you know, someone curled up with a teddy bear or Larsa reading this book every time they're going to bed. And I also just want to say, yes, you would expect like a Dan Giesling or a Parvati or Sandra to be a traitor. And it's sort of obvious that they probably would have picked a housewife, right? But I just want to lastly say that Phaedra Parks is running away with this show. She is such a delicious traitor. She's so fun in relishing in it. And because she has the built-in housewife alliance, she is so good at going undetected, but also so devious in how she's playing the game. When she was consoling Larsa after Marcus was taken out, when she was wiping tears away from Deontay's face because the stress of the game was getting to him, she is really, really fun in this game, and I love watching her.
No, it's nice to see when somebody is surprisingly suited to be devious. You know, I mean, not that she isn't on that show, of course, like, you know, hilariously sinister as she sometimes is. But on this show, she is much less detectable, one. And two, she's smoother at the game than Dan Giesling, who literally spent all of his time on Big Brother telling us how good he was at this kind of thing. So it is really cool to see.
And Varys, one last spoiler, because this happened in the third episode, very smooth at protecting people that she wants to. That chalice moment with Parvati, where she said, oh, you're not about to kill Shireen.
Yes, yes.
She eyed Parvati.
Yeah.
Like, that is smooth. And also just smooth in the fact that episode 3, Dan and Parvati are discussing what to do with the chalice. And then you get a confessional from Phaedra where she's sort of talking about whoever they kill, she will find out about it because her MO of playing the game is, I don't spend time talking to or hanging out with the people who are the traitors until we get to that room.
Right.
Whereas Dan and Parvati are sort of conspiring together a lot, but they're used to a show where you have to do that if you're in an alliance with someone.
Right, right. Oh, no, these are literally the most seasoned at this activity people in existence. There's nobody else who has done this more than Dan and Parvati.
Well, this week we have got the Emmys, of course, another awards season episode from us. And we also have Mean Girls, the musical, the movie, which is out. So we'll get into that excellent joke about Mean Girls from Tina and Amy at the Emmys last night.
Yes. Oh my God. They were maybe my favorite presenters the whole night. I mean, as expected, they're wonderful at this.
It should have been longer. Yeah. I was expecting a whole weekend update from them, which would have been really fun. But we also have the delightful Mayor Hawthorne here to talk about his new album, For All Time. So we've got a pretty good episode for you coming up next. There's a lot to keep track of in a high-stakes election year. Voting deadlines, volunteerships, emergency therapy, also maybe your job or whatever.
That's why Crooked and Vote Save America created a comprehensive 2024 planner. It's filled with important dates, motivation, and some fun extras to keep you focused, sane, and organized. For the record, we tried to include a few Xanax, but the lawyers told us no.
Start this high-stakes year off right. Head to crooked.com/store to get your planner now. And also maybe some sleek black breaking innerish fits because I plan on stealing some elections this year.
Dominion Girl, we love you.
Keep It continues our award show coverage with the Emmys since the awards just took place. The season of Ayo has reached its zenith. And we all know I'm talking about Ayo Edebiri, and also Kieran Culkin as well. his rise has sort of reached its zenith now, particularly for him, I guess, because Succession is over now. But Ayo is sort of risen up as the star within the Bear. And I sort of see a lot more awards in her future for this show alone. You know, I think it's only in season two. So it seems like one of those shows that the Emmy's going to latch on to, and then we'll keep rewarding it for years to come. And it's helpful that it's not just her as the lead getting a lot of awards, or it's not just Jeremy Allen White. You know, there's a full cast of people that it seems like the Academy wants to celebrate and probably will over the years.
Well, let's just be clear. Giving a speech at an award show is its own art. I mean, truly, it takes preparation. It takes planning. It takes a sense of humor and awareness about yourself and an awareness of the audience. And even if you don't have Anthony Anderson's mom yelling at you about the time you have, efficiency is key to making it work well. And Ayo Edebiri is just all of those things. She clearly respects comedy because it's about, she has like quick joke, quick joke, quick joke, sincere thanks, sincere thanks, sincere thanks, and I'm out. There's never a lingering for even a split second when she gives a speech. And of course, we just saw her do that at the Critics' Choice Awards and now the Emmys. Weirdly, last night, I don't know that I have ever seen an award show run to time like that before. It started at 5 and it was done by like 7:57.
Yeah.
You know, like not a second over. And a big part of this, as I just said, was Anthony Anderson's mom, who is a big part of his comedy. They are always working together. She works with him on his reboot of To Tell the Truth. She's always on that show. She interrupted Jennifer Coolidge's speech and told her to speed it up, which when it happened, I have to tell you, I got a little antsy, you know, because Jennifer Coolidge.
I did too. I did.
Maybe she takes an extra second to give the speech, but the lines are there. Like Jennifer Coolidge comes to play when she comes to an award show. So I felt a little upset on Jennifer's behalf. But at the same time, I do believe she traumatized everybody into playing by the show's rules.
She did.
And maybe that's why everybody got their speech down to time. So I kind of am thankful ultimately, even though I think Jennifer Coolidge had 3 or 4 more awesome jokes in her by the time her expected win for White Lotus was over.
Absolutely. But I will say we've heard them.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm ready to move on from season 2 of The White Lotus. And I'm ready for Jennifer Coolidge to be in anything else.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't really know what we can expect from her coming up. I'm excited. Which, by the way, did we ever even just discuss White Lotus season 3 casting? Because there are a couple of exciting names.
Carrie Coon.
No, here's the thing with Carrie Coon. Put her on any TV show. I mean, she's like Edie Falco or something. She's like, she belongs wherever you put her. But like Parker Posey, who is so amazing in so many movies. We talked about Party Girl recently on this show.
Mm-hmm.
I need her to be amazing. I need it to be the best performance that's ever been on The White Lotus. I'm worried we're going to get anything less than that. And I just need this for her. And the reason I'm thinking about her, I needed a new audiobook after I finished the, you know, 48-hour Barbra Streisand, I'll say masterpiece, but it's really just, I'm going to call it a zoo. It's not a book. It's a zoo. Parker Posey's book is the one I'm listening to next. And so I'm tapped into her journey as a true Crispin Glover level weirdo.
Has Parker done television?
She did do Lost in Space, but you're right. She's largely the indie movie.
Okay. Yeah. My Lost in Space has Joey Tribbiani in it. Okay.
She also was in Grace of Monaco, a movie that has been lost to time.
Oh, wasn't Nicole in that?
It is Nicole and Milo Ventimiglia and the idea of Monaco. That is what is happening in that movie.
4 things I love, but you put them together?
Yeah, not much going on, weirdly. Nicole Kidman, once upon a time, was routinely compared to Grace Kelly. And I want to say it's because of her hair in The Others. But otherwise, no, not nothing. I mean, like they have nothing in pleasing voices. They have nothing in common to me. I don't know why we thought we could do that.
Was the Mika song the theme for the movie?
That would have been inspired, actually. Actually, it wouldn't have been inspired. It would have been like in Maestro when they play It's the End of the World as We Know It, so we can hear the words Leonard Bernstein. Bradley, what was going on? No.
Every time I find someone who says that they love Maestro, I'm always very confused. But I will also say that it doesn't inspire... I was angry last week, but that's just because we're supposed to be angry on this show. It's called Keep It, you know? And it really doesn't inspire that much ire in me. You know, I'm just sort of like, huh, Okay.
It was very much Ado About Nothing is what I would say in that movie. Yeah.
Which, by the way, when I went to see Anyone But You, I discovered that it was based loosely on Much Ado About Nothing. I did not realize that until I started watching it. And I was like, these two are being awfully Beatrice and Benedict. And then when all the Shakespeare quotes kept popping up in random places throughout the movie, I said, you know what, Will Gluck? I've had enough.
Wow, I didn't know that. I should have put it together because, by the way, the title totally sucks. And I guess it's now maybe a little bit of a throwback to that title. Anyone But You is just so 1.5-star VOD rom-com from 2007. I just can't believe it's the title.
Yeah, it was an enjoyable movie, I will say.
I enjoyed it. Yeah.
I did enjoy it, mostly because of Glenn Powell's body.
Yeah, no, we talked about this before. She, I felt like, needed to do the Aniston part of a rom-com a little bit better. And also, by the way, it's a movie that takes place in Australia where Rachel Griffiths is a character, but she's not playing Australian. Guys, what is with that Ouroboros? What happened there?
She's also blonde. And so it took me quite some time to figure out who it was.
Interesting choice. Right. No, I did not know on first glance either. Anyway, back to the Emmys. You know what I found, unfortunately, a little bit depressing about this Emmys, even though it was a swiftly run Emmys? Mm-hmm. They had all these quote-unquote reunions of old TV shows, except every time, two or more people were missing. So it just wasn't a reunion at all. They did Cheers. So who's on stage? Mr. Ted Danson, of course. Mr. George Rent, John Ratzenberger, Rhea Perlman, Kelsey Grammer, who is on Frasier still, by the way. But who was missing in this Cheersery? Bebe Neuwirth. Shelley Long.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a reunion if I'm not seeing Shelley Long.
What happened to women?
That's what I'm saying. Precisely. Kirstie Alley, of course, can't be there. I don't remember the reasons why. But if you're going to do a reunion, it just has to be full. Like, they did Ally McBeal and, like,
well, she's half dead, of those Lewis. People.
I know. Where's Lucy Liu? Where's Vonda Shepard? Peter McNichol, yeah. Lovely to see him. But it just wasn't a full reunion half the time.
I was also wondering who cooked up the reunions. Listen, I love the production of this Emmys. It was the first time there was an all-Black executive producer team handling the show. But I do want to know what was happening behind the scenes with the picking of the tributes. And I guess it's who's available, you know, too, and what tributes you're going to do, etc. But the mishmash of, like, jumping from different show to show was fun at times. But sometimes they worked, sometimes they didn't. But that's always just going to be the nature of comedy and things like that. You know, I felt like Charlie Puth singing I'll Be There For You was lovely. I always love seeing Charlie sing. But the absence of the Friends cast made me think maybe they are going to do something to honor Matthew later. But then also they just did the Friends reunion too with him there. And it's probably still raw, so they don't want to do anything as well. The Grey's Anatomy one was the weirdest.
Yes, because again, specific people are missing. T.R. Knight, right. Where is Sandra Oh?
Yeah, where was a cut to Isaiah putting anthrax into letters in his bunker in the woods? It was very nice to see Katherine Heigl, though, who is glamour, okay? Katherine Heigl, I love that bitch. And it was nice seeing her on stage with these women again. Yes.
Put her in red? Oh, show business. Yes, we missed that.
That was a reunion that was really nice to see, if only knowing the history of all of those people and seeing them back on stage together. That sort of tugged at my heartstrings. And I fucking loved the Martin reunion. You know?
Oh, please. To Gina Arnold, who Keep It alum. Utter treat. The comic's timing is still like pop, pop, pop. Tisha Campbell, fabulous, even though I believe she did sue Martin Lawrence in the last season of that show. So I was happy to see them reuniting, too.
Yeah, they had an unfortunate lawsuit situation going on. But it was nice to see them all. And Thomas Ford, he passed away, but it was nice to see a photo of him on the table. And Carl Payne was always so funny on Martin, was the funniest on the stage to me, by the way. And why didn't we get an Emmy bit? It can always be a little sad, especially when it's just Black people doing it, because like we know why you didn't get an Emmy, because you weren't a white show and you were on Fox. But I will say, Carl Payne making the Emmy joke very funny paid off more when the It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia cast riffed on it. And I actually loved seeing them united too. And it was very funny them talking about, we've been on the air for 15 years. We've never even been here before. And then you have Danny DeVito there where he's like, oh, well, I got some Emmys.
Also, it's just cool hearing, like, I was backstage at the Emmys doing Kimmel's bit with Guillermo where he interviews all the winners sitting back to back with them. And I was backstage when the It's Always Sunny cast was on TV, and when we were watching a monitor and Tichina Arnold passed by and she was looking at the TV and Danny DeVito mentions Taxi and she just screamed at the TV, yes! Like, because she loves Taxi. It's like, I don't know. There's something about the Emmys where it is nice just to remember, oh, remember those old shows we still all remember and love? That sounds so basic. But it's like, under what other circumstances would Taxi be brought up on TV even? Like, you don't even really hear Danny DeVito talking about it much anymore. So it's nice to see a program like this, not just honoring the fact that there are all these old TV shows that you may or may not be seeing on streaming anymore, but also, like, we still remember them. We're quoting those shows and stuff. So I was just pleased to see that.
I really loved that aspect of the show, too, because I feel like the Oscars are really fun when they celebrate cinema and celebrate everything that's been in the theaters that year, regardless of whether or not it's nominated for something, right? Yeah. And I think that this Emmys was a good step forward in that direction, because there's a lot of fucking TV shows out there. And if you're going to have a ceremony where The Bear and Succession sweep everything, and it's boring for everyone else to even be there as you're seeing this happen, and there's sort of like no suspense or upsets that might necessarily happen in the Globes or the Oscars, it's less likely that there are going to be upsets at the fucking Emmys. It's nice to see things celebrated. And I think we could go even a step further. Like, have people from other shows that are on the air and celebrate those genre shows and other things, you know, and let people really feel the love of television. Because not just Martin and It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, I just constantly think about shows like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, you know, which people loved so much when it was on the air, and critics constantly championed that show, and it only ever got, I believe, one writing nomination, and that was for the episode Hush in season 4. You think about shows like that, which aren't the prestige shows now, or weren't the shows that were primetime network dramas on the big networks like ABC, NBC, CBS. Those were always historically ignored. And I think that the Emmys should do a lot to celebrate TV that I feel like everyone watches, because wouldn't the ratings go up if, you know, like Riverdale or something isn't going to be nominated? Pretty Little Liars isn't going to be nominated. But shouldn't the cast be there? And shouldn't we see clips and things from the shows that people actually do watch at home?
Or and like older shows that have like gained legs over time,
yeah,
you know, things
exactly.
like that. I will say there is something about the idea of quote unquote TV that everyone watches that I think has made the Emmy Awards rollout less interesting, because I feel like they're still kind of clinging to a monoculture vibe. And so the rare TV show that everyone does watch, the Emmys sort of feel obligated to acknowledge or award right away. Like The Bear is a rare show where it kind of got around to everybody, you know? And so it's like Schitt's Creek, like that year where Schitt's Creek won everything. And I feel like that feeling makes voters say, oh, this is necessarily the best if it's, you know, reached that large an audience, and they feel awkward ignoring it. But at the same time, to give TV shows something in every category just feels bizarre to me. I don't know. It's just like, I don't think any one TV show is that much better than any other TV show.
Voting down ballot at the Emmys is very weird.
Yeah, right. It's just like my old maxim. I don't trust anybody who stands one thing. You know, there's something wrong with you if you think one thing is necessarily the only great thing in existence or so much greater than everything else.
And I tweeted this, but I felt like, and we've talked about this before too, the voting for something every year too, it is not to take away from things winning stuff multiple times, but also when Modern Family, or you used to have The Amazing Race winning all the time, or you would have
Veep or whatever.
Yes, all the time. It is, there are so many TV shows and there are so many people doing amazing fucking work on TV. And it's just, it's so weird that the Emmys in particular, as opposed to film awards, really just sort of the voters dig in and get their comfort thing and sort of celebrate it all the time. And at least you always have people constantly doing something different in film. So that's why you get different people getting nominated sometimes and different wins, even if it does end up sort of being the same people winning stuff all the time, like a Meryl Streep or something. It feels a little different and it feels like there's more variety, you know? But that's because actors have to work with different directors and writers and production teams in every movie, you know? And it's just sort of, the show did it 1 year. It's like, they're not doing the exact same thing every year. And sometimes you can't even tell me that the people are still watching that certain shows 3 years later. It's just, well, it was good this year, so it's always going to be good that year, you know?
No, it's an interesting voter conundrum, because it's like, you do want to vote for the best thing. And so if something is the best 1 year, it's likely that the quality won't utterly diminish the next season. Like, you may want to honor it again. But I think there's also this other, like, devil angel on your shoulder saying, like, but it's boring to give the same people the same awards, especially if new things come along. And, you know, if there's a new TV show, it's responding to a new feeling and culture. So it's like, there's more relevance necessarily to that thing, right? Or in theory. So I do find the battle that voters have with as Emmy voters interesting. But at the same time, I just feel like we're moving to a place where, because there's such a variety of television and so many people are voting, that in a communal way, they are obligated to pick the thing that the most people have seen and agree is at least a little bit good. You know, it's less, they're less likely to pick a riskier thing, you know, because they're clinging to the power of monoculture, which, as we know, is dwindling. It's why Taylor Swift is still like the Grammy queen, right? She's like the only monoculture thing. So you have to necessarily give her awards.
If she gets best album this year, there will be a riot. For me.
one-man riot. I'd like to see it.
And also, obviously, The Bear got into the public consciousness because Jeremy Allen White became sort of a hot star, you know, and the Calvin Klein-ness of it all. And Io Debris is also become a star. It's been so interesting to see both of them rising at the same time. Also, it is Io Debris. I keep saying Ayo because of the Nicki Minaj of it all. But, you know, in case there's anybody in the YouTube comments with something to say, I'll meet you in Gag City.
Where you're imprisoned. You can't leave. You're the only one there. Yeah.
One of my favorite speeches of the night, which was very heartfelt and also funny, joke, because it came from a very funny person, Niecy Nash.
Oh my God. Who doesn't want to see her win awards? She had a daytime Emmy before. This is her first primetime Emmy. But when she said, "I'd like to thank me," we haven't seen behavior like that since, I believe, Little Richard. And that is a legacy. Yeah.
And it just felt so self-affirming too, and very relatable. And when she was in the press room afterwards, she expounded on it and just said that when you are an actor working for so long and you're constantly told no, or you're not right for this part, etc., you're not getting any recognition from your peers or your industry, only you know how many times you've cried at night, how many times you've wondered, you know, how are you going to pay your bills, like if you're going to get another part. And so she did want to thank herself, and I love that.
Also, you can only support people who come from Reno 911, because there's something about that whole cast where they constantly brought it, and that show was never... Like, it's weird to put that show in a prestige space because it was so fucking silly, but you knew everybody was operating on, like, a master level on that show, too. So for anybody to emerge, like, Wendy McClendon Covey, I'll always stand because it began there, you know? Niecy Nash winning awards is just why we tune into something like the Emmys. It's like, yes, immediately when you're on my television, I know you are in control and I am in safe hands. And she won for, by the way, that fucking Dahmer thing, which I would think that would be the last thing Niecy Nash would be in, and yet she was fabulous. Claus was also amazing. Yeah. Getting On was also amazing.
I'll never know how good she was in Dahmer because I don't ever plan on watching it. But Niecy Nash is fantastic all around. And we could pretend that that award was for Claus. And also the standing ovation for Christina Applegate, another fucking star.
Oh, what a great way to open the show. What a great way to open the show. And also, she's very funny, too. She, like, kept it clippy, moved it along. It was emotional. And then we were right into the ceremony. It was very well-timed and articulated.
Yeah. Shout out to 9/11, too, by the way.
That is the craziest part of the show. They were talking about the history of TV and the great moments we've had all over the years. And, you know, usually that means the I Love Lucy Vitamita Vegemin episode. That means, you know, Sammy Davis Jr. kissing Archie Bunker, et cetera. And then they dropped in 9/11 as if it was like some programming miracle we all got to witness. Very, very strange choice. Uncomfortable. Deeply a mistake.
Les Moonves did 9/11, actually.
No. But first, 9/11. Yes. That's a Julie Chen Moonves joke right there for you.
I am so obsessed with her podcast, by the way, her Jesus podcast, and how after each season of Big Brother, where she interviews someone in the cast and asks them how important God is to them, and they either freeze up or start talking about God. I remember, I forget who it was, but someone from the season basically said, yeah, God's not really part of my life. And that interview wrapped up so quickly.
Also, it's a creepy question. It's like, are you the mom from Carrie? Stop. Yeah. Or a character in Saved or something.
I read Carrie recently, by the way. Very good book. And it also gets into a bit of the backstory a bit more, too, that I don't think I picked up from the De Palma movie. A bit,
yeah.
But, you know, when Carrie has the tampons and everything thrown at her, there's passages where the teachers are talking about her, the gym teacher's talking to the principal, and you get a little backstory about how Carrie White's mom used to be at the school and how she was crazy, and they're like, well, now we get it. You know, so, great book, by the way.
And rest in peace, Piper Laurie, one of the best ever to do it.
Yeah, me recommending Carrie in the year of our Lord 2024, but it's a good book, so... All right. When we're back, we will be joined by Mayor Hawthorne to discuss his new album, For All Time. Keep It is brought to you by Barefoot Dreams. Lewis?
Yes?
When you see footprints in the sand, that was when I carried you in my Barefoot Dreams robe.
Now, is that a Leona Lewis song? No?
If you want to bring coziness into your life, you turn to Barefoot Dreams, especially now as the brand is celebrating their 30th anniversary. With those 30 years of coziness, Barefoot Dreams celebrates being the originators of everyone's favorite luxe home blanket. And while many have attempted to duplicate their blankets, robes, and more, Barefoot Dreams' fabrication and quality cannot be replicated, so don't believe the dupes. Girl, this blanket is it.
I effing love this blanket. I'm thinking about it right now, and I want to jump in my bed, which is sponsored by something that we'll do another ad for momentarily. Get ready. There's a reason why Barefoot Dreams has been on Oprah's favorite things list 6 times. Jesus, get a life, Oprah. My God. Dressing head to toe in Barefoot Dreams is the key to comfort, as their collection of ultra-soft robes, loungewear, and accessories are made with premium materials. Their products make the perfect gifts, too. I throw this thing on. I wear it like a shawl. I look exactly like Ellen Burstyn. And I am the coziest a human being can be. Because, by the way, it's still that time in Los Angeles where it's, like, pretty mild outside, and then your apartment is cold. I can't explain it. I don't know things like basic science. For Keep It listeners, you can get 15% off your first purchase at barefootdreams.com with the code KEEPIT15. Don't miss out on Barefoot Dreams' soft, soothing fabrics that will bring luxury to your life.
I'm Jessica Reeves, and I've been analyzing and reporting on extremism for the last 10 years, and I have the gray hair to prove it. Subscribe to our podcast, Extremely, for an always eye-opening look inside the daily work of exposing, fighting, and disrupting all facets of extremism. My co-host, Oren Siegel, and I explore this ever-changing landscape and bring you stories of people and places impacted by extremism, those who fight to protect our communities, and those who offer new perspectives. You can find Extremely wherever you listen to podcasts.
Here you are. BPMs high, sweat dripping, body moving, tongue panting. You're working hard, real hard, and you're thirsty. You need vitamins, nutrients for peak performance and energy.
And your plants do too.
Aww.
I mean, just look at the little guy. Water-soluble plant food from Miracle-Gro is full of essential nutrients. Just a little scoop into your watering can and boom, instant feeding and bigger, more beautiful plants. It's kind of like a sports drink for your plants. You may have to suffer from heat, but your plants do not.
Our guest today we would describe as a true musical powerhouse. You know him as a master of soul and from groups like Tuxedo and Jaded Incorporated. He's worked with artists all across the musical spectrum, and his most recent album, For All Time, is a testimony to his next chapter. Welcome to Keep It, the Grammy-nominated, always cool, Mayor Hawthorne.
Damn, man, you guys just made me sound so much cooler than I really am. That's great. I love it. What's up? Thank you. Long time listener, first time caller.
I'm always blown away when people have listened to the show before because I'm just like, no, go find something else to do. We'll be blabbing no matter what happens. Go away. Go do your cool art. Yeah.
Nah, my wife put me onto you guys. And
thank you
wife.
To her.
And
all right.
But I listened to you guys and I was like, oh my God, these guys are detail people like me. I'm a detail man. So you guys just are obsessed with the minutiae of things, which is exactly how I am.
I feel like if you're a musician, like you can just endlessly go down a rabbit hole of obsession, 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 getting things right. Like production never, ever ends.
Yeah. I mean, I'm listening to albums that came out 5 years ago and I'm like, oh man, I wish I could go back and redo this part of this thing. I could do that so much better. You just gotta, once it's out in the world, you just gotta chalk it up to this. It's not yours anymore.
So what do you think about, I guess, maybe things that you obsess over, like the details? On this show, we're constantly talking about, you know, our pop culture things that are in our brains and we can't get out of them. Like, what's in your brain all the time? Like, what are the details that you think that you stress over?
You guys are unbelievable. Like, drop the brain supplement routine. Like, are you guys doing Ginkgo Balboa capsules and shit? How the fuck do you guys remember it?
It's a curse, actually. It has nothing to do with vitamins. We did not choose this. It is simply the way we are.
Are you guys doing crossword puzzles every morning?
It's funny that you say that. I actually just started to become a crossword person. It annoys me that there are some tics to the crossword that I have to learn, like certain like words that come up again and again. And I'm like, oh, right, we have to keep, like Esai Morales. I have to keep using his first name because it doesn't belong anywhere else in the world. Esai only comes up in his name. But yeah, that's becoming a part of my routine.
It's me and my wife do them every morning. It's like part of my thing. It's how I keep my, trying to get like you guys, man. Trying to get my brain sharp again. I feel like I forgot more things than I've ever learned.
No, I feel like at some point I got into crosswords again too, because I feel like the thing I was trying to do this thing where you're supposed to do those or other brain. I downloaded this brain teaser app, which I never use, and then it always reminds me that it's time to do a new teaser before bed, and I ignore it. I'm trying to do that thing where I'm like, yeah, those are supposed to help you keep your brain sharp as you get older. But then I think about the fact that I can remember episodes of like The Practice from 1998. So maybe I don't need it particularly.
So, I mean, the way that you guys can remember like who choreographed this scene in a Dorothy Dandridge thing from 1961, like that's the way I am about records, about music, about vinyl. Like I can tell you who played the bass or who did, you know, which model of Yamaha synthesizer was used in this solo on the Cars you know, debut in 1979. It's like, I know all that shit. This is great. It's that, that is also my curse.
Now, I want to say, generally speaking, you are categorized as neo-soul, which I feel like is a term that has secretly 100 different definitions. How do you feel about the label neo-soul?
I mean, it's just same way I feel about any label, pretty much. I've never met a musician ever that has been like, yeah, I'm a neo-soul artist. Like, or even a I'm a alternative rock artist. Like, no musician has ever gave a shit about a genre of music, like a category. It's like, we're just making music, you know? And it's only the labels and like, so many of those categories were invented by iTunes and the record stores because they need a way to organize everything. But we don't care what you know, I could give a shit. It's like,
that's interesting to hear. I guess you saw sort of the like the micro labeling that has happened because of the internet. But you, as a person who's sort of a purveyor, a connoisseur of vinyls and older records, you know, how would you say that things have just sort of changed from the ability to stroll through the record store and picking up vinyls? I would assume that everything used to be labeled more just by name, to be honest. Or maybe they weren't. I didn't become a vinyl store person until much after, you know, people were buying them. I was a Sam Goody person, you know, going through the CD bin.
Yeah.
And then I discovered vinyls, I feel like, sometime after college when I was living in New York. And it became cool in the mid-2000s to buy vinyls.
Man, I definitely was shopping at Sam Goody, buying $20 CDs in the mall. But
that's exactly how much they cost. Yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah, they were so crazy. The markup on CDs was the greatest lick era for the music business. It was crazy. They were just minting money at that point. Before the CD burner came out and you could dub the shit for free. But I mean, yeah, the categories is all about, you know, record stores and yeah, how they need to, a system for organizing everything. But I will say, I mean, and I am a vinyl guy for sure. Like, I'm such a vinyl nerd, and I love the like tangibility of vinyl and, you know, the sonic quality of it, the crackle of it. It's like, it just feels so much more real than an MP3. But that being said, like, I listen to Spotify all the time. So it's like, I'm definitely, you can't just like exclusively exist in a world of vinyl records. It's just not realistic.
Do you have vinyls like displayed at your home in any way? I feel like if I became a serious vinyl collector, it would be about showing them off in some way or framing them. Do you have music that you display?
I have my vinyl library. So we just moved to Pasadena and I built like a brand new vinyl room, like a record room at the new house. It's pretty insane. I'll send you guys a photo of it. It's definitely nuts. It's where I do my like wine and vinyl live stream show. But it's out of control, you guys. Like, it's truly out of control. There's just thousands and thousands and thousands of records.
I feel like I am constantly going through, sometimes when I move, I get rid of one, or I'm constantly having friends ask me, like, what do you listen to your vinyl records on? And I'm sort of like, what do you recommend for people if they have them? And just sort of one that's not going to Target and buying a vinyl record player or something, you know, something that's sort of like an intro for people to listen to something, but it also sounds good.
For like a record player?
Yeah, like what did you recommend that's not just like, I'm ordering one off of Amazon and then it comes in and, you know, this vintage Shaka vinyl sounds like shit on it or something, or scratching up the record, you know?
Yeah. Don't buy the Crosley. That's going to just chew your records to pieces. Go, I mean, The best move I would say is to go on Craigslist or, you know, whatever, and get a techniques turntable from the 80s, and those things will last forever. It sounds way better than anything they make now. There's a new one from a company called Audio Technica that's pretty mm-hmm. good, that you can buy at like Best Buy or whatever. But
no, I'm listening to your new album, For All Time, and it's clear that you relish in a throwback vibe. Like, I keep thinking of the mid 70s when I'm listening to this. How important is it for you to incorporate sounds of yore into music? I just feel like most, for example, popular music right now, like, I can't think of anybody who has a truly retro vibe who is like constantly, we're being constantly bombarded with at CVS when I walk in. You know, Pink doesn't sound like she belongs to 1975, for example.
Nah. And like, my records definitely do have so many of those vintage elements, and that, you know, it's comes from my love of vintage soul music. But at the same time, like, I never ever want people to listen to my records and like be confused about whether or not it's new or not. Like, I want you to know when you know from the second you put it on, oh yeah, this is a new record, but it has that timeless feel to it.
Yeah, I mean, I remember the first time I even discovered your music. I think it was probably circa The Walk. And that was sort of like the song that pulled me in. But then I will also say that in the end of the year in my Spotify list, Henny and Ginger Ale is always in the top 100 each year on every year in rap lists. I actually started ordering that in the bar after hearing
no
that
way.
Song too. Yes, I have, and it's a pretty good drink. So I mean, I like
it's Tennessee pretty in damn good, right?
Yeah,
it's not bad, man. All my ignorant Detroit friends got me hooked on Hennessy from an early age, and it's once you get it in your system, man, you can't let it go.
I truly have a bottle that's on my bar cart in my apartment, because I have two particular friends who love it. One of them's from Detroit too, and every time that they come over, it's always restocked for them because they're the ones who drink it the most.
Man, I swear they're like sprinkling it in the water supply in Detroit. There's something about it, man. We just love it over there.
I want to ask you about other artists that you've worked with, and not particularly just working with. People that you've, sort of been on tour with. Lewis brought up the fact that there aren't any sort of modern artists right now who, you know, sort of have that big throwback vibe that you'd be hearing at a CVS, which is interesting because you opened for Amy Winehouse on her last tour. And I would say that was the last time where a very popular artist who was making music that was in the top 40 was being played everywhere, and she had that whole very throwback vibe too. I guess sort of what was it like working with Amy during that tour, and what do you sort of think that we've missed in music since she isn't making it anymore? Like, was there a direction we were going in that was fun that you feel sort of like there's a hole there now because we don't have Amy right now?
She was just an unbelievably special, gifted human, for sure. I mean, she obviously had her like very sad, off mic issues. But when she was on stage, the moments that she was on stage singing, it was like revelatory. It was crazy. I still to this day have never seen anything like it. I mean, it was just so unbelievably captivating, and there was a real like power to it that is just so rare. But I think a huge part of what made her so relatable for everyone was that it wasn't just like the music, the sound and the feeling of it was very retro, but what she was talking about in the songs felt new. Still, it was like, oh yeah, I can actually relate to that, what you're talking about. And it didn't feel like your parents' music.
Yeah, there's a quality about her that I think there's just a quality about you and her where if you're incorporating all these old styles of music, what it means is you're reverent and you've been paying attention. And so there's just something right. I naturally trust about that vibe. Like, oh, here's somebody who is not out here just to say I'm new and important, but I am at a particular point on a timeline and I know what came before me. And I just think that makes you seem, I don't know, mature, I guess is the word.
I'll take it, man. Yeah, I mean, I do my homework for sure. It's like, I really care about this stuff, man. I think it comes through in the music. I hope it comes through in the music. And, you know, one of the really cool things about like working with artists like Doja Cat and, you know, Jordan Ward and Blue to Tiger and Max and all these like cool, very cool up and coming artists is that I can kind of like be the guy in the room that knows all those references. I can, you know, I work with young artists all the time who are going for like, you know, let's say they're going for like, I want a new Jack Swing type of feel for this song, but they don't know Bobby Brown. And I can be like, yo, he did it like perfect, as good as you can do it, you know? And I can kind of be the guy in the room that like knows all the references. It's been really, really fun. And it's been super inspiring for me, like just to get to work with all these like younger artists. Cause it influences me in my own music. Like it keeps me young.
Referencing, you know, people like, Bobby Brown, you know, or, you know, other faves of yours like Steely Dan, you know, like you have all these musical artists in your brain. And me as a person who listens to so much music, you know, sometimes I'm always like, what exactly do I want to listen to get into the mood? But then I always have the stalwarts that I always return to. I mean, who would you say amongst your vast knowledge and love of music are the artists or particular albums that you always find yourself returning to? And that you feel like maybe if you introduce them to someone, it would be like a perfect encapsulation of who you are as a person.
Steely Dan is a big one, man. I always say, if you don't like Steely Dan, I probably don't like you as a person. It's very divisive, though. It's very, very divisive. Like some people really can't stand it. And I think, I don't know what it is about it, man, but the Delphonics is something that I always that type of sound is something that I always go back to. What else, man? There's so Prince is another one that's like can be kind of divisive, I think, but maybe less so now that he's gone, but there's something about Prince. I mean, and the fact that he wrote all the music, played all the instruments himself, you know, he played the bass, he played the drums, he played the keys, like every single part of those songs is him. And there's something like, you know, I obviously don't play the instruments anywhere near as good as him, but I'm doing a similar thing with my own music where I play most of the instruments on my records and I'm writing the song. So I've always had kind of like a connection to Prince in that way.
Yeah, he is sort of like if Mozart could jump into the splits. I mean, just it's a very unusual, one-of-a-kind skill set he brought to the universe.
There is nobody like him, man. And then, you know, they asked, I remember they famously asked, when Jeff Beck died, I think they asked Eric Clapton, like, they asked him, how does it feel to be the greatest guitarist left alive? And he said, I don't know, go ask Prince.
And then he said 20 other anti-vax things, unfortunately.
So, and then he said some other really offensive shit, like super offensive shit after that. Yeah.
I have to applaud you on this album because you know, a big feeling in it is it's about this, you're married, and the feeling of having a sort of eternal love. And I just have to say that in the abstract, that can be a boring subject. Like, oh, I'm married and it's going well. You know, not a lot of conflict there to go into. But, you know, every once in a while we get a song like, for example, Drunk in Love, which, you know, does something with the idea of being married and really enjoying it. Is it at all daunting to approach this subject and come up with compelling material based on it?
man, so daunting. It was something I was really nervous about because I was like, oh no, you know what? Now I'm married and I'm like happy. And then what do I write about? Like, that's not interesting. But then I realized that like all of my favorite songs that I listen to that I love are love songs for the most part. And they don't have to be boring. Like you can do it in a way that's not boring. And it's like the last thing that I ever want to be is boring. It's the worst thing you can be is like middle of the road. Like I'd never want anybody to listen to one of my records and be like, yeah, it was cool. It's all right. Like I either want you to love it or be like, yo, this is not for me. So I think I figured out a way to make it not boring.
I would say that you have, and I would actually say that Lewis sort of asked like the exact last question that I was going to ask, just because having listened to your progression of albums, you could see mentally, emotionally where you are with the concept of love. And it seems that you've gone on this beautiful roller coaster to where you're in this sort of great, beautiful place with it. And I think that this is really a great album and one of my favorites of yours.
Man, thank you so much. Yeah, I really wanted to be like, I'm in my Barry White era for sure. Like, I just want to be the guy that you listen to in the bedroom. Because I just feel like we don't have that right now. Like, who do you listen to when you're in the bedroom? Like,
The Weeknd.
I was going to say the French group Paradis, Paradis, from like 10 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
Hemisphere. I love that sound too.
Yeah, yeah.
But you're right. The Love Unlimited Orchestra. We're not getting much of that recently. You're right.
No, you're not. Which Kim Petras album do you listen to?
You know, Kim Petras is more about the precursor to sex. You know, if you're in the club, right, you're getting right there. It's a little too camp to hear slut right pop or fuck me like a slut while you're actually in the moment, you know?
Right. Once we've actually gotten through the fucking like a slut, I don't need to actually put the message out there anymore.
Right. Then you don't need it anymore, right?
I mostly say The Weeknd because, you know, like there's bass and he sort of has this feel of something that feels like it should be a sex record, but you have to ignore the lyrics.
Yeah.
Usually he's mad about the whole process.
That's tough. You do got to kind of tune that out. I do think, yeah, I agree that I think like older Weeknd is maybe the closest thing we have to like that Barry White, that modern day Barry White thing. Anyway, I'm trying to be that. I want to be that guy.
Oh, well, thank you so much for being here and for this album and also bringing up Barry White. I feel like it was we talk about so much shit on this show, so I can never remember what it was, but I truly feel like last year Lewis and I were talking about a deep cuts of Barry White, because I feel like in popular culture, especially when we were growing up, Barry White was sort of, you know, the deep voiced joke and like this is a romantic song, and there are like two songs that people right know in pop culture, but like if you visit his deep cuts, they're not just romantic songs, but they're like funk, like club songs that you would want to turn on to his version of slut pop.
Yeah. Oh no. Yeah. The maestro goes deep, man. Yeah. He was an incredible artist. Yeah. His catalog is crazy. One of the best producers ever too in music, the sounds that he got from the drums and the bass and guitar. I mean, he was a real innovator. It was incredible stuff. He definitely doesn't get the credit in that area that he deserves.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And the album is on repeat. I so love it.
Thank you very much for having me. Appreciate it. Thanks, Ira. Thanks, Lewis.
You got enough to do already? I do. That's why I use Shipt same day delivery to keep up with my busy life. They know the snacks I like down to the extra creamy in my peanut butter. I can get deliveries at home, on set, or even when I'm away on vacay. And my personal shopper Amber, she's got my back. As in, she asks them to check the back if it's not on the shelf. Shipt, delight in every delivery. Learn more at shipt.com/hi.
On this episode of Plant Killers, we'll explore One Nation's most notorious fruit and vegetable killer, bad dirt. What makes bad dirt so bad? The answer? The ingredients. But fear not, true crime enthusiasts. This story has a happy ending. New Miracle-Gro Organic Raised Bed and Garden Soil. It's made with quality organic ingredients from upcycled green waste like compost and aged bark. Unlike the other guys who can't say the same. Looks like bad dirt's murdering days are over, thanks to Miracle-Gro. Join us next time on Plant Killers.
As a chef and a restaurant owner, I'm as meticulous about my cookware as I am about my ingredients. That's why I love Made In Cookware. Each pan they make isn't just designed to perform, it's crafted to last. As a mom, I love that I can trust Made In. It's made from the world's finest materials, so I can feel good about what I'm feeding my family. I'm Chef Brooke Williamson, and I use Made In Cookware. Shop chef quality pots and pans at madeincookware.com.
So we have both seen Mean Girls, the movie, based on the musical, based on the movie, based on the novel Push by Sapphire.
Based also on the book Queen Bees and Wannabes by Rosalind Wiseman. Yes.
Yes. Which I remember reading.
I'm sure it taught you all you need to know about being a bitch. I'm sure you needed a big old primer or primer, whatever the word is.
When I was working at Barnes & Noble, it was there, and I picked it up. And for some reason, I did not know it was a guide to mothers on how to help their daughters navigate high school. But speaking of the new movie, what'd you think of it?
Well, I'll say this. Going into it, I expected a retread. You know, like, I know that there are songs in it. I wasn't that familiar with the musical other than the song World Burn, which I've heard performed before, which is the main Regina George song. And I know Renee Rapp as both a powerful singer and also a zany interviewee. Off the chain. She'll say anything. It's confusing.
She is brassy.
She's so off the chain, it's confusing. Anyway. I will say this. For me, it's a thumbs up for a movie. I don't think the songs are good. Like, I don't have any of them in my head afterwards. I don't remember them. However,
they're bad.
Yeah, not good songs. Confusing. The jokes in the movie, I got a little sick of them being reiterated from the first one. Obviously, they felt indebted to the original script, which is filled with all these lines that have stuck in popular culture over the years. You know, the "It's October 3rd," all of Regina George's lines, etc. But for the most part, Tina Fey punched up her previous dialogue, and man, is it just good to hear that voice again. As I was saying with Ngauri Rice last week, once upon a time, Tina Fey would write something and then it would be on TV immediately, and then you would see it and be laughing at it with everybody you knew. And like, that's just not the world we live in right now. She actually is doing now a TV show version of the old 1981 Alan Alda movie that he wrote and directed called The Four Seasons. That's turning into a TV show,
wait.
And she'll be starring in it. I'm so excited for that. It's such a good movie. One of the best marital fights ever in a movie between Alan Alda and Carol Burnett. Sandy Dennis, my favorite actress, plays a scream of a character. She's a boring wife who is divorced, and her main hobby is drawing vegetables. So funny. Anyway.
If you want to pair that with another film about a couple going on a trip and meeting another couple, and, you know, there's sort of wacky hijinks going on. I just watched Bitter Moon for the first time, and man, that movie is something. Polanski, we love him, but it is...
Oh, yeah. What he stands for, who he is, where he is. Yeah.
It's a wild, fucking, horny and movie that is also about, you know, like, kinks and things like that, but it's really quite good and weird. So that's recommended. Pair that with The Four Seasons.
I will say this about the casting in this movie. Surprisingly, I did not find myself comparing this cast to the original. And I don't know why that is. Like, I felt Renee Rapp was different enough from Rachel McAdams and Mean Girls that their performances didn't even overlap to me, even though they're saying a lot of the same things. Like, even if you just compare the ways they both say, "get in, loser," they don't remind me of each other. I feel like we're talking about two different movies. in terms of new casting, I thought the triumph was Avantika, who plays Karen, the Amanda Seyfried role from the original. First of all, it was nothing like the way she played it. Second of all, it was so in your face, confused, daffy, harebrained, and yet funny when it came to singing the songs in a featured character actress way, that I thought it just stood on its own, belonged lovely. And she just a pleasure to watch.
Yeah. Listen, I'm just going to be frank.
Yeah.
Who cast Aaron Samuels?
It's tough. I don't know what happened there because he wasn't bringing it on any level.
And there was no charisma there. And he just sort of, he's a cute boy, but he sort of looks like one of the, he looks sort of like Bill Skarsgård's son, you know? It's not giving the Aaron Samuels that, you know, you're going to have. And I could see N'Gowry Rice's character falling for Aaron Samuels. It was very weird that Renee Rapp's character is obsessed with this boy, you know? And I also kept waiting for, okay, maybe he has a song. Maybe there's a reason why Aaron Samuels even exists in this movie. But it wasn't just the casting. Aaron Samuels is sort of a non-factor in this movie. Completely.
Right. And also, like Jonathan Bennett in the original movie, there is a, like, dream boy quality to him. And he's not giving you, like, he's not never quite giving Katie the time of day. And so there is this, like, aspirational quality to wanting to be with him. Whereas this character felt utterly approachable.
Yes. And he liked her immediately, sort of from the jump. And even though he's supposed to be stupid, he doesn't seem very stupid in this movie, whereas Jonathan Bennett played him with a sort of sweet good-naturedness, but he was also an idiot, you know?
Yeah, right. Yeah, you could believe that he sort of was dialing it in terms of his schoolwork or whatever. I enjoyed Ali'i Carvalho as, of course, of Moana fame, as Janice in this movie. Now, I'll say this. Lizzie Kaplan added a verve to the character that I think was maybe slightly missing here. That said, I also believed the queerness of this character a little bit more with her.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Janice's queerness was more hinted at in the original. And I will also say that the main problem with this Mean Girls, I think everyone has sort of said this online, you could take the word mean out of the title. This movie has no bite to it, to be honest. It's just, it's perfectly nice and pleasant.
It is not quite mean enough. Yes, right. No, and I don't even know how that happened. Maybe it's just because there's more time singing, so it just seems less mean. I have no idea.
Well, I feel like some of the jokes were tampered down a bit and made to be a little bit nicer. And people keep saying that this is a reflection of Gen Z, but let me tell you something. Gen Z is full of cunts. Have you not seen them online? They are rude as fuck.
And they have the time.
Yes.
Like, oh, is your day not ruined yet? Well, let's dig in.
So, I think you can be mean and nasty in a movie like this because they're quoting the original Mean Girls all the time, which is a mean and nasty movie in some parts.
I did believe Renee Rapp as a nasty mean girl. That said, another relationship I didn't understand was the Lacey Chabert character, the toaster strudel, whatever. I didn't see how she would be friends with Renee Rapp.
Yeah, she sort of was just there as well. The Plastics didn't feel as unified, to be honest. But I will also say that, getting back to Renee, I said it before, I would describe her as brassy. You know, I really enjoy that goofy song, Not My Fault, that she made with Megan Thee Stallion.
So good. Love it. It's in the closing credits of this movie.
Yes. I don't know if they became friends before or if she sort of really loves Megan and maybe modeled herself after her. But let me tell you, the most mesmerizing thing in this movie is just watching Renee Rapp walk through a hallway. Just she's got sort of like a stallion-esque, like, build to herself. Like, she looks very much like Megan Thee Stallion. She's so captivating. She walks with such a presence. I love her so much. And she has a great fucking voice, too. So, it's nice seeing this version of her. It's nice seeing her on, in other roles, and it's nice seeing her in interviews. She just feels like an all-around sort of fun person, and people responding to her Watch What Happens Live interview where she jokes about being ageist. It's fucking funny. Get a life if you hate it, because if you hate it and you're constantly whining about it, you're going to be one of those people who results in her becoming media trained and not being funny in interviews anymore. So, like, shut the fuck up. We want celebrities to be funny and entertaining. We don't want them sitting there saying everything boring that's going to make people like them on social media.
Yeah, I have to actually say I agree with that. The ageism quote was also just pretty funny. It was so random. Like, where are you coming from on this? I was pretty bowled over by the verve of it. That said, okay, I got into a fight with a friend recently about this. And I'll be honest, I thought we were all on the same page. We were talking about whether the original Clueless or the original Mean Girls is funnier. And I thought as adults, we had concluded that the original Clueless is not only flawless entertainment, I would describe it as the Madonna of comedy movies, which is to say there is a fuck you fabulousness to it, a take it or leave it. The characters are extremely witty. They're also a little devious. They're just fucking real. Like, I don't know, not contrived in any way. And Mean Girls, of course, is very funny. There's some jokes there, but it's playing within the archetypes of a high school movie the way most high school movies do. So I find it a little more replaceable than what Clueless brings. I'm here to say definitively, Clueless is a 4-star entertainment and Mean Girls is a 3-star entertainment. Ira, what do you think?
Oh, all right. Well, both of them have 5 stars on my Letterboxd.
Okay. 5 stars. Whoa, what is this? Premier Magazine? Ugh, I hate the 5-star scale. Can we fight about this too? What does 4.5 stars to 4 stars mean? There's no differentiation there. The 4-star scale has enough increments that each specific level has meaning. This is important to me, and Letterboxd has lost me this way. I need them to reach out to me.
I was talking to a boy at a party recently who did tell me that I'm a little generous with my stars. But I will say that that is a hard question, because if you're saying that that's Madonna, I would say that Mean Girls is Britney Blackout, you know? Because I think that they're both okay. Great in different ways. And when you ask me also, which is the better movie? Clueless is the better movie.
Yes.
I may be laughing at more minute to minute is Mean Girls. Which is not to say that Clueless isn't funnier and sort of better and just sort of like with the characters and the way that it's presented. But Mean Girls does have more minute-to-minute jokes in it. So I'm constantly laughing at it. I think a lot of the beauty of Clueless is it actually has a bit more heart and emotion than Mean Girls that works in it. But in those scenes, you don't necessarily need to be cracking up, you know?
Okay, I kind of concur on that.
It's more romantic than Mean Girls. And I think a romance is a lot different than a straight-up balls-to-walls comedy.
I think the inspired nature of the story of Clueless also makes it funnier, though. Like, for me, the original Mean Girls, and my friend Maren Fluker just said this, and I'm basically cribbing her right now, the happy ending of Mean Girls is a little unearned. And it feels like the ending to any movie, whereas I feel like every step of Clueless is not contrived. I know this is a different conversation than what is funnier moment to moment, but I think that nature of I don't know what's coming next in Clueless still makes it funnier. Like Cher even talking about Elton and saying he just wants things to be beautiful. Like her weird observations about people are so like built in brilliant character writing. And I think that is something Mean Girls lacks. Even though it has really fun characters, really funny characters, I'm not seeing something elevated beyond that.
Well, I knew where it was going because I've read Emma Lewis.
Oh, God.
Pick up a book.
I was just wondering if we could toast Jane Austen more in this society. Jesus Christ, not a name we hear fucking 50 times a year still.
You know what's very funny? Brandon Taylor put up a picture he had taken of a new edition, I believe, of Pride and Prejudice. And in the back of it, it has quotes from other authors at the time and how much they hated the book or didn't like Jane Austen's writing. Like Charlotte Bronte is in the back of a quote being like, I don't know what's going on with her writing.
My sisters and I fucking hate it. And one of them's dead already.
All which is fun.
By the way, that's every once in a while on Jeopardy, they will literally have categories about writers shading each other. Just go ahead and look up that Goodreads or that Brainy quote or whatever. Writers calling each other full of shit or whatever. A constant blast.
Uh-huh.
Oscar Wilde and Walt Whitman and all those people just sounding off. Good time.
Yeah. I mean, who did Langston Hughes like?
Oh, that would be fun to look up. Is he like Gwendolyn Brooks? I don't want to hear it. Yeah.
Anyway, the movie is perfectly fine. It's not great. It's not really good, but I enjoyed it. I am disappointed that I saw it at a screening at 4 p.m. In the middle of the day at the Paramount screening room, because I probably would have enjoyed it a lot more if I were drunk and saw it with a rowdy crowd in a theater.
Mm. One element from the original that I think is better in this version than the last version, and I can't say that about many parts of this movie, Tim Meadows. I thought he got harder laughs this time than last time. And it's so good to see him. What a venerable comic actor.
Yeah. He's very funny in this. John Hamm could have been funnier. John Hamm's always funny, but I feel like a lot of the jokes about the gym teacher, when you take out the whole Trang Pak-ness of it all, there's really nothing else going on with the gym teacher, so it's not as funny. That Reginald joke really got me. And also the iCarly theme song. Jacqueline Spivey was very funny in it, which is
I did not bring him up. He is fabulous. Yes, yes. As the new Damien. Yeah.
Yes. He was also in A Strange Loop on Broadway. And while I did not think that performance was as captivating to me as when I saw Larry Owens in it off Broadway, he was fantastic in Mean Girls. So a really fun and exciting cast, too. So I give it a sideways, the rare sideways thumb that, you know, Siskel and Ebert and then Roper later would give on the show. It has to be a sideways because I don't really want to give it a thumbs down. I really don't want to give it a thumbs up either.
I want to be clear that there is a Sesame Street sketch where they talk about sideways thumbs, and it's very amusing. You forget how much they permeated pop culture that they would be on fucking Sesame Street. But anyway.
Can I tell you that I recently discovered that there used to be a controversy online about the fact that Elmo was eating up Sesame Street and was taking away time from the beloved characters?
I am anti-Elmo, bitch. I do not want to hear his whorish laughter. I do not want to hear... With his bug eyes, I don't want to see it. Grover has the comedy chops. Grover, baby. Grover has the vulnerability. Grover is a terrible waiter, and we love him for it.
Yeah, I'm a big Grover fan. I don't know if I brought it up on the show, but I had...
Tickle me less. I do not want it.
I never wanted the Tickle Me Elmo as a kid. I had a Grover doll since I was as young as I can remember, and I truly kept that thing up through high school, and then I gave it to my niece when she was a kid and she tore it apart. I had that Grover doll restitched several times as a kid. He was missing an eye and everything, but Grover will always be my favorite Sesame Street character.
The way he's constantly embarrassed. Oh, I am so embarrassed. It's like, come on, Bob Newhart. Come on, dry comics of yore.
You know who Elmo is? Leah Michelle.
No, don't say that. You were doing so well, and then you called him Leah Michelle.
No, Elmo?
He is the funniest girl. He is the funniest girl. That I will say.
Yeah. Anyway, Elmo, keep it to Elmo.
Fuck off. Fuck off. Don't look at me. Go learn your numbers.
Also, feuding with a rock.
It was sad.
Talk to your therapist about that.
He's a sad girl.
When we're back, keep it. All right, we're back with our favorite.
I just want to say, I would stand Prairie Dawn before I stand that motherfucker. Okay, moving on. Sorry, I'm done. She at least knows where she's from, the prairie. Go ahead.
All right, we are back with our favorite segment of the episode. It is Keep It. Lewis, mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
What's your keep it today?
You know what's interesting? I thought my keep it was going to be slightly different before I began this. I originally was going to say keep it to the new Ariana Grande single, Yes And, which didn't do anything for me the first time I heard it.
Likely for you to do.
To me, this is a song that needs a particular place to be successful in, and I can think of two. Heard it in my car, good driving music. A house beat, you know, keeps me trucking along as I'm going down Santa Monica Boulevard, whatever. Also, group fitness classes. It's very Soul Cycle, the nature of this song. And that's an okay single. That's something that belongs. We, you know, music belongs certain places, and this is where that belongs. Where she lost me was in the video for Yes And, which is a tribute to Paula Abdul's Cold Hearted video, which, of course, is itself a tribute to All That Jazz, the Bob Fosse movie from 1979. If you're going to do a tribute to a Paula Abdul video, I don't know, could you dance? Could you move the feet? Paula Abdul, the thing about her was, obviously, she had really popular singles. All those songs endure to me. I think they're all great. But Paula Abdul really was a throwback dancer type, like a Sid Charisse, old school Hollywood person who really loved to like get out in front of an audience and tap. And I mean, there's no other word for it. Jive. She is a jiver when she is on stage. And that energy is very essential to what the Cold Hearted video is and why it's such a good video directed by David Fincher. In this video, Ariana Grande is truly leaning and sort of being tossed around and walking. I just don't know why you would toast this particular video if that's what you're going to do. Just, I don't really, I don't expect dancing from her, but then don't do the tribute to the dance video because I don't know why we picked this one.
Yeah. Honestly, she could have done the Opposites Attract video because she's already dating MC Scat Cat. So I don't see why we had to do the Cold Hearted video because you're not even better than Naya Rivera doing it on Glee, which was a hot number.
Precisely. Precisely. No, it's confusing to me. I do love like throwbacks to old music videos just because I feel like more and more of them are being lost to time. And if you don't see, like, if you don't hear the song on Drag Race, for example, I don't even know the conduit through which, like, a Gen Z person would end up seeing these videos or hearing these songs, even though they're chronically available on YouTube, of course.
I actually want to say to the YouTube thing, one, we should fix that algorithm. I hate the YouTube algorithm now. I feel it's a little bit like the Spotify algorithm in that I used to think Spotify playlists were so good. They would give me new songs that were in the vein of what I sort of wanted to listen to if you pick just a playlist off of one song. But now it's the algorithm is growing smarter. You know, they're like raptors. They can open doors now because the Spotify algorithm just gives you songs you're already listening to.
Yeah, right.
I don't get anything new in them anymore. And I feel like YouTube does that too. YouTube should have an option where they are, if you are faggots at an after party or pregame and you're watching videos, it should be offering you classic videos like Cold Hearted Snake or classic live performances from the 80s, 90s, 2000s, instead of just giving me another Tove Lo and Jessie Ware video. Like, come on, where is the variety? YouTube is not doing enough to educate the masses.
I do want to say, by the way, that I was undereducated about how good Tove Lo's videos are. That's a good YouTube K-hole to go down.
Yeah, Tove Lo. As how it should be pronounced, you know.
As a chimney sweep would say it, yes.
Period. Right. second thing, I brought up Naya Rivera doing Cold Hearted Snake on Glee, and I'm now thinking about how weird it is that two Big Sean exes have done tributes to a Paula Abdul video, the same one.
And who's the other one?
Naya Rivera and Ariana Grande.
Oh, I see. You link them up. Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah. Maybe he's at home putting on Vibology. Maybe that's his bedroom music.
For another tribute to Cold Hearted that I think people should listen to, Cat Graham of Vampire Diaries fame did a cover of Cold Hearted Snake that I love.
Baby, Cat, I'm a Graham cracker, okay? Put Your Graffiti on Me was a song for the ages.
I love that song. Love that song, yes.
I love Cat Graham. I saw her perform Put Your Graffiti on Me at the Abbey. one time.
Where it belongs. a place I will graffiti myself. Yeah.
You know, once upon a time, I saw Charlie XCX and Kim Petras perform there. So Kat Graham could go on to having gays talk about how she's the best thing ever, even without topping the charts, you know? So,
okay. Potential promise. We love it. Ira, what is your keep it this week?
My keep it this week goes to Monica Garcia on The Real Housewives of Salt Lake City. Now, Monica Garcia was a new cast member this season. She was a former cohort of Jen Shah, who is currently in prison. She's also a person who testified against Jen Shah to the feds and then worked her way onto this show. Later come to find out that she was running an Instagram account called Reality Von Teese, where she was trying to take down Jen Shah, but also just posting gossip and rumors and baseless things about the other women of the cast for years. And that was discovered not by her exposing it herself. Basically, her lies just didn't add up. And Heather Gay, one of the cast members of the show, did some investigating and then exposed her in the season finale of this season. And shout out to Heather Gay for doing that and producing a great episode of television. There are a lot of gays online who are in love with Monica. I think she was great this season. I thought she was a very fun villain. But at the end of the day, she did not contribute to why that finale was great. She was basically just lying to the women all season, and she only got interesting television out of it because she was exposed. And so I don't know why we're obsessed with the idea that Monica needs to be on the show next season. She's revealed herself to be extremely corny. She did a photo shoot after the Reality Von Teese expose, which was kind of funny. But after that, she's one of these people who's constantly tweeting, constantly posting screenshots of texts that she has with people. It's just sort of like, girl, you're doing too much. And at the reunion this week, she brought a burn book to the show, which has more gossip about the women. And it's like, first of all, grow the fuck up. And two, you're doing free promo for Mean Girls, the movie. Like, I know you didn't get a check for that.
It came out this week. Yeah, right.
Yeah, I know you didn't get a check for that, girl. Okay? I do also want to give a brief keep it to Andy Cohen, who read a tweet of mine in the reunion, which set off a little bit of a bomb at the end of the first part of the reunion. But I know that he is locked into those cue cards and just sort of reads them out loud. But he said, Ira Madison 3 tweeted, and I just want to say, girl, why are you reading my handle? You know who I am.
Ira Madison 3. That's giving Dear Evan Hansen. Ben Platt, who played Dear, he gave everything.
But that was a fun treat. And he had recorded that reunion, I believe, around the time that he did our show. So he had the knowledge that he had called me Ira Madison 3 in his brain already.
I don't know if anybody in the history of time with an III after their name has ever been called 3, unless you're like Henry 3 and you're reading the Shakespeare First Folio or something.
Yeah, or like one of Elon Musk's kids.
Yeah. but there's like unpronounceable symbols in those, so that's not even the same thing.
Yeah. Anyway, great season of TV, though. And my position is that The Real Housewives of Salt Lake City is sort of like a Desperate Housewives. You have the four core women and a bunch of crazy people who pop up each season and either torment them or add some flavor to the show. But you don't need to keep, you know, the psycho going forever, okay? We saw what happened on Melrose Place when that happened, okay? Monica Garcia will just end up being like Eve, dressed in a cheerleader costume, running around trying to blow people up and poison them. And I don't really need that. Also, she's broke. They were in the Bahamas and she was paying for a purse with a Chime card. Okay? I don't watch the Real Housewives franchise to see broke, relatable people. Okay?
I have to say, aspiration does seem to be the key ingredient of this show. Even if they're gossipy assholes or whatever, you do have to aspire to something about them.
Okay, I'm not watching to see you fly Frontier, okay? I'm in the Delta Lounge. Not this year. Not this year because the strike sort of took away my diamond status, and I'm back down to gold. It's been a very trying time for me, Louis.
Oh, sure.
But yeah, I used
maybe
my
the
last
bus is right for you.
Destiny's Child doesn't even perform that song anymore. Okay, I'm not gonna get on the bus. Anyway, I had to use a certificate to get down to Miami, where I am currently, by the way.
You're dressed the part.
If the people, I realize that only the people watching Keep It on YouTube will know that I'm not where I usually am in New York. So, mi gente Latino, as it were, or Wepa.
Oh, you sound like my favorite Latin woman, who is Madonna. And by that, I mean she sure isn't.
Yo tiendo means I get it.
Spanish Duolingo lesson over here. Yeah.
Spanish lesson.
Oh, yes.
One of my
good
favorite
callback.
Goofy songs of hers.
She, you know what? She is underrated in the goofy department when it comes to music. There's always like a what the fuck were you thinking song on here. That's usually a little funny.
Yeah. Anyway, that's our show this week. Thank you to Mayor Hawthorne for being our guest this week. Off of our conversation, respond in the YouTube comments to what music you fuck to.
Yeah, it is a good question. Also, it's like, I mean, I think a good answer is I hate fucking to music sometimes, but like other people religiously insist on it. So I need to hear from those people.
Yeah, we all know that you're like Isabelle Huppert in the bedroom. Silence, no talking, yes. Popcorn. No drink.
Certainly no snack. Certainly no snack.
And there's vague French happening and a woman staring out of a window crying.
The piano lesson is a lot like what goes out of my bedroom. Just know that.
All right. We will see you next week, as always, with more Keep It. Don't forget to follow Crooked Media on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. You can also subscribe to Keep It on YouTube for access to full episodes and other exclusive content. And if you're as opinionated as we are, consider dropping us a review.
Keep It is a Crooked Media production. Our producer is Chris Lord, and our associate producer is Malcolm Whitfield. Our executive producers are Ira Madison III, Louis Vertel, and Kendra James. Our digital team is Megan Patzel, Claudia Shang, and Rachel Gajewski. This episode was recorded and mixed by Evan Sutton. Thank you to Matt DeGroot, David Tolles, Kyle Seglin, and Charlotte Landis for production support every week.
Elmo sucks. I'm sorry.
It'd be a shame if he killed himself.
Younger people love Elmo because he was pushed on them.
Right. And he's screaming. Oh, I like the thing that I can't fucking get out of my ears because it's screaming. Picture you're at a brothel and the loudest madam will not stop laughing. And she's smoking. You know, just that like gross energy. That is Elmo.
You know, kids don't love Oscar or the Count that much anymore because they're barely on the show.
Those are characters. Yes. Oscar, point of view. The Count, autism.
As a chef and a restaurant owner, I'm as meticulous about my cookware as I am about my ingredients. That's why I love Made In Cookware. Each pan they make isn't just designed to perform, it's crafted to last. As a mom, I love that I can trust Made In. It's made from the world's finest materials, so I can feel good about what I'm feeding my family. I'm Chef Brooke Williamson, and I use Made In Cookware.
They say plants like music. Yeah, no, like really, they respond to the vibrations of it, which means that this playlist you're listening to, the plants are too. You know what else plants like? Organic soil from Miracle-Gro. It's made with all the best stuff like wood fiber and compost. Plus, it's OMRI certified organic, which officially means it's made with superior ingredients. And when you give your plants the stuff that makes them happy, they won't judge you on your iffy playlist.
Hear that, plants?
So go ahead and give them Miracle-Gro.